Welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. We'll just have a few headlines tonight as we're still getting used to the absence of natural E. And on tonight's program, Dr. Drew Lanham, who will be in town. He'll be in Lawrence speaking at the library on Thursday night and leading a birding expedition at the wetlands on Friday morning. He'll be speaking Thursday night, and we'll have him on the phone shortly. He's on a mission to diversify the ornithology community, and we'll hear about his passion for nature, his birding conversation, conservation ethics, and what happens when a black man goes birding in rural American woodlands. And Richard Mabian is here as well, so he'll be jumping right in. But first, we've got a couple of headlines. First, Democracy Now! Reports that in a reversal, the NASA administrator says that humans cause climate change. So back, NASA's newly confirmed administrator, Jim Bridenstine, affirmed the science of climate change on Thursday in a break from the Republican Party and from his own previous statements denying global warming. Speaking to NASA employees at a town hall meeting at the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C., the former Oklahoma Republican Congress member said his position on climate change has evolved. In 2013, Bridenstine demanded President Obama apologized for funding climate research and falsely said from the House floor that global temperatures stopped rising during the early part of the century. Also, Democracy Now! Is reporting that the Columbia has ordered thousands to evacuate amid fears that a dam may burst. This is along the Cauca River, and as heavy rains threaten to breach a hydroelectric dam under construction, at least 600 people have been left homeless after workers cleared a blockage at the mega dam in northwest Colombia, causing a surge in river levels downstream that flooded homes. So Colombia has ordered the evacuations of tens of thousands of people. And then also the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today has reports that Ameren is planning to build Missouri's largest wind farm, a 400-megawatt wind farm, and this will be its High Prairie Wind Farm near Kirksville. So, again, that's St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporting that. We'll keep you posted on that as things develop. And that's about all the news we do have for now. So we do have Dr. Lanham on the phone. Are you there, sir?
I'm here, Mike. How are you?
Great. How about yourself? And now, Dr. Lanham, let me introduce you to Mr. Richard Mabian. Mr. Mabian?
Hi. Good evening, Dr. Lanham. Pronounce your last name.
Lanham.
Lanham. Good evening, Dr. Lanham. It's very nice to meet you. I'm looking forward to having this this interview with you. I really love your comment that you have on the website. I guess this is what we have, or birding, why black. I like that.
Thanks. I've been doing it all my life.
You've been doing it all your life?
I have. Been birding since I was about 8 years old. So, you know, that's by math, that's 45 years of birding. So, and I've been proudly black all that time. So it's been.
Yeah. Well, we understand that. So where are you from originally that you started at 8 years old?
Edgefield, South Carolina, which a lot of people have probably not heard of, but it's famous, or I suppose infamous, in many of our eyes, as the home of Strom Thurmond, the former senior senator from South Carolina, who wielded a lot of power for a long time.
Oh yeah, we know who Mr. Thurmond is. Believe me, his reputation preceded him across this country, especially in our communities. So you got an early start at bird watching. I'm having problems. I keep cutting in and out. So if you if I drop on you or my voice, you understand that's what's going on. So did you grow up in a rural area or did you grow up in an urban community? Is that urban?
No, Edgefield is very rural, as is most of South Carolina still is, fortunately. Okay. But Edgefield at the time that I grew up was still, I believe, about 80% rural, or classified as about 80% rural. So I grew up in the forests and fields and along the creeks that were in an inholding of the Sumter National Forest. And so I was surrounded by National Forest and on a family farm of a little over 200 acres there. And so that was sort of the genesis for me growing up in a rural environment where both of my parents were school teachers, and so they were folks who knew the advantages of an education and especially of a science education. So that was always there. But then my playmates in many ways were the birds and tadpoles and all of those things that kids find to entertain themselves when they grow up in a rural setting.
Okay, so you was pretty much isolated. I mean, when you say your friends, your playmates, and you use the insect world, outdoor world as your playmates. No brothers, no sisters, no neighbors, no folks in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I had siblings. I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger sister.
Okay,
but I was raised in sort of a unique situation that I spent a lot of time with my grandmother.
Okay.
At her home. And so every day I would ferry back and forth between my parents' house, which was just across the pasture, really, from where my grandmother lived in her house. And in the book, I call her house the ramshackle, and I call my parents' house the ranch. But I would shuttle back and forth when I was old enough. I would walk back and forth not quite a quarter of a mile or so to her house, and sometimes it would take me, you know, just a few minutes, and sometimes it would take me half a day, because I found a great joy and entertainment in watching birds, listening to birds, learning their habits, poking sticks into holes, you know, skipping rocks, climbing trees, doing all of those things. And so, you know, when I would finally join my siblings, sure, we would often play as siblings do, but I spent a good bit of my time alone. And that was by choice.
Right.
Now understanding myself as I do.
Well, I'm asking you these questions because in many ways I think that you and I have a lot in common as far as our childhood is concerned. I grew up in the woods. Okay,
sure.
I mean, I have one good friend, but he didn't move into my neighborhood until he got to be around, maybe 13, he moved out. His family moved in our neighborhood. And he and I, in the mornings when we get up to keep from being yelled at all summer, we head to the woods. I mean, we even, you know, we even dug us a little cave down there. I mean, I went back and looked at it when I was grown and realized how we could have got covered, but he only covered us up. Nobody would have even known we was back there covered up.
Oh, yeah.
But so I, being outdoors was my cup of tea also. I mean, but I did not go the bird route. I shot birds. You know, we take the pellet guns and the BB guns back there in the woods,
yeah,
and we was shooting at the animals running around. And it's really interesting to see how you went the opposite way of actually of having them as an item of interest, you know. And I'm very intrigued with that, to hear that coming out with you. The being the being black and in your field is not that unusual be alone. I'm pretty much alone in this field, and I'm living here in Kansas City. So it's not a lot of us that's involved with this environmental world, but yours is at a totally different level. I'm also the first black board member for the Sierra Club, okay?
Awesome.
So that means all of my Sierra Club brothers and sisters would be more inclined to be like you than they would to be like me, okay? I mean, they like going on outings, and I'm always talking about getting out there with the mosquitoes and the ticks and all kind of stuff. They eat that stuff up. So now you grew up in that area, graduated, went on off to college. Which college did you go to?
I went to Clemson University, where I got my zoology eventually, and then my MS in zoology. Went off, beat around really in South Carolina, worked for a couple of years, and then came back and did my PhD in forest wildlife at Clemson. So I've been at Clemson my whole career.
Yeah, and this outdoor stuff with you is not by chance either. I mean, you spent your life engaged in the academic field around that, right?
Yeah, you know, Richard, it's funny. I did. I started off in engineering, and
okay.
I started off in engineering in large part. Well, really, the only. But after my father had died, I wanted to lessen the burden on my mother as much as possible to pay for my education, and so I was awarded a full 4-year DuPont scholarship to any school in the country for engineering. And as much as I wanted to go to school in zoology or wildlife ecology and those types of things, I was pretty much just doing so because people said, well, first of all, you're not going to make any money doing it. And also said, well, you know, you're a black kid. That's not what black people do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I got you.
You know, you should be an engineer, enough money to enjoy what you want to enjoy as a hobby. It's about your school, and you need to be an engineer, because otherwise, what are you going to do with a zoology degree? Be a zookeeper?
Yeah.
And that was sort of that was the attitude. And so I had to swim upstream against that tide of influence for about 3 years. I stayed in engineering for a little over 3 years, and then one day, and it felt like I was dying by the semester. Every semester that I was in engineering, I felt in many ways like I was missing my calling, that I was somehow wasting my life, and that my passion was draining away. And so when I finally changed to the zoology major and was able to follow my life's passion, it was like a rebirth to me.
Well, that's amazing. I was just having a conversation with a young lady before we came on the air out in the green room, and we were just talking about how that happens in life. You know, it just what you went through, I went through those same kind of changes of having that, because we had those black parents that were, you know, you get a education, boy, you can write your own ticket, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that became your drum beat. I mean, and even though you may have felt like, well, hey, man, there's something else I'd like to do, you felt a obligation to achieve what your parents had spent all their time trying to get you there. I was standing to her because this new generation we got is right there too. They're like she was just saying, she just can't see herself, you know, 40 hours for 50 years, you know, and then deciding, let me go out and enjoy life. And I'm not talking about to be foolishness, but you know, you have some things that you would like you just said. They wouldn't want you to make that your hobby, but this is where your heart was, you know. And like I told her, that's the same way I've lived my life. You know, that's why I end up being the only black person out here in this environmental world, because what I'm doing is more from an academic perspective of teaching others, And so I get great joy out of that, okay?
Sure.
I'm sitting there talking to you. See, here's my concern, and I'm going to see where you at at this. Let's go with the pushbacks. And I know there's a whole lot more about what you do that I could sit here and you could talk about and I could ask you questions about. But I find working with in the inner city that parents have a problem okaying their kids to go on these outings. Do you find that to be an issue?
Yeah, I have. Even though a good bit of my work is not in the inner city per se, I think that generally, Richard, what's happened is that, you and I, you just talked about wandering and digging caves and hillsides, and I talked about, taking all day to wander, and there's a general sort of lack of trust that's evolved, right. and that results in parents really, in many instances, holding their children back from opportunities to learn, to be exposed to new things. And as that happens, we're hamstrung. And so we haven't been to these places or seen the things that other children have the opportunity to see and experience. As you and I both know, travel, even if it's across the river from where you live, is important. It's
right.
Important to gain that perspective. And so, yeah, that's an issue, especially as you talk about, taking kids out to somewhere familiar. If you wanted to take them camping, for example, or someone has said, well, that's dangerous out there, don't go, even with proper supervision. Parents, and even sometimes when they let their kids go, they have loaded them up with so many preconceived notions of what to be afraid of and what to expect that the children can't truly open their hearts and minds to learn,
right?
Because they have been so biased against it.
I'm with you on that, and I see that all the time. I can almost pinpoint behind incidents that have occurred where children from urban areas have been taken on trips. I mean, kids from L.A. have been as far away as Oregon, going up in the hills, and got attacked by some kind of bear or something, and those stories become front page news. Those kind of stories is what they know people who live in the urban areas want to hear, and so they tell you about this one we just had of the two young men who got attacked by the mountain lion. That receives a lot of press, as if this is what goes on, and those are rare instances of what really is going on out there.
Sure.
We're gonna take our first break, folks. Before we do, a couple things I want to mention: that Dr. Lanham will be speaking at the Lawrence Public Library on Thursday evening, and then on Friday morning leading a birding outing out of the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center. So we'll find out more about that.
Yes.
And also, I guess if folks are interested in joining the conversation, they can call 816-931-5534 if you want to ask Dr. Lanham a question. And we'll be back after these messages.
On the next Alternative Radio, Abby Martin.
You have to be an internationalist. We have to stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters worldwide. And as an American journalist and as Americans in general, we have to focus on ending the U.S. empire. Keep our eyes on the ball. This is the world's source of suffering. This is the greatest threat to humankind. And it's our best hope to actually enrich millions of lives around the world and actually hope for a just and equitable future.
Wednesday, 9 a.m.
Hello, my name is Joseph Jackson, host of Cowtown Conversations, where we discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Dr. Sinnott. Tune in for our next episode, where we'll be talking about opioids and the opioid epidemic with Dr. Burgess of Truman Medical Center. So tune in to Cowtown Conversations, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
A Pennsylvania river reveals its true colors on this current cast.
When I was a little girl, I grew up along the banks of this river, and we used to go splash around in the water, and when we would come out, our clothes would be stained orange.
That's Melissa Reckner of the Kiske Kamina Stream Team. She says the orange was iron oxide from abandoned coal mines. It didn't harm Reckner, but it made the water too acidic for fish and other wildlife. Eventually, the state green-lighted funding so watershed groups could treat the mine drainage before it entered the rivers. Reckner says efforts have been ongoing for more than a decade and will need to continue. But today, people float, boat, and fish in the Kiske Kamina rivers. And now, if you go in the water, your clothes come out clean. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
And we had a vigilant listener call in to make a correction. It is the Lawrence Public Library that's bringing Dr. Lanham in, but he's actually going to be speaking at Liberty Hall on Thursday night. And again, that outing on Friday morning at the Baker Wetlands. And Mr. Mabian, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, let's talk about this at the wetlands, this birding alley. Now, basically, what will you be doing?
Well, I'm all about seeing new spaces and sort of understanding how everything fits. So, I always compare everything to my home base. That's my control. So, here in the upstate of South Carolina, there's a bird community that I'm familiar with, and I'm sure there will be some birds that we share between Kansas and South Carolina, things like great blue herons and red-winged blackbirds and Canada geese and mallard ducks and common nighthawks, those kinds of things. But I'll be looking to see what's different, you know, to see how that place compares to my place. And I'm sort of constantly doing that. And I tell people in many ways I'm sort of in that role, I'm constantly assessing new habitats and understanding not just how the animals fit, but how people fit in those places. So I'm looking forward to that outing, but also sort of understanding this will, believe it or not, it'll be my first visit to the state of Kansas.
Oh, wow.
This will be my 46th state, and so I'm looking very much forward to finding out just what these wetlands are like. They should be very productive this time of year.
Yeah, it really should be. And you'll find Kansas probably in many ways will compare to South Carolina. You probably will. Are you back in your hometown in South Carolina?
Well, my wife and I live in a little town right on the other side of Clemson called Seneca, South Carolina. So, I'm right on the edge of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Okay.
So, that the Cherokee used to call the Blue Wall. So on most days you, come up over the hill and there's the Blue Wall. So we live just a few minutes of a red-tailed hawk's downhill glide from there.
Oh, wow.
And then just about 10 minutes from the university.
Okay, so you just named off one of those birds, the red-tailed hawk, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think you're a very interesting guy, you know. And so when you go on one of these birdings, do you label them, or when you see them going by, you take out binoculars and what do you do?
Well, Richard, I tell people that I'm odd, ODD. It's and I describe that as a condition. I have what I like to describe as ornithological distracted disorder.
Oh, you had to go there, didn't you?
there's hardly ever a bird that passes by or sings that doesn't catch my attention. It's hard for me. I wake up in the mornings normally, if not before the bird sings, when the first bird sings, I'm up, because that sound to me means that the day has started and it's time to rise. So, yeah, I try to name as many birds as I can, but I also spend a lot of time, and not just listing birds, but spending time trying to do what I call absorbing birds.
Okay.
And that means to to really to spend time looking at a bird, watching a bird, being a bird watcher. Okay. You know, I'm a birder, but I'm also a bird watcher, and I think it's important sometimes to slow down and notice not just the rare birds, but also the common birds that are around us, because they have interesting lives and they're a part of our communities and who we are. So, you know, as I compare and I bird and name things, and maybe we talk a little bit about their ecology and sort of how they fit into a Kansas place or a South Carolina place, you know, it's an opportunity for us to see how we fit in the environment as human beings, as people, because in many ways our fits are just like the birds, I would like to think.
Well, you know, in many ways you are awakening new interest in me. And because I also love birds. After I killed my first one and felt horrible, I stopped shooting them and stuff, and they became part of my environment. And so even where I live right now, while you was just talking then, I was sitting up thinking about how many times I just go to my front window, out on my front porch, and I just sit up and observe the birds and watch what they're doing. The red birds, I love them. I love red. I'm a red bird fan.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a red bird fan. If I see one, boy, I'm watching them all over the place. But the birds feel friendly and comfortable in my yard because their problem is the cat that lives next door more than me. They realize that they are a part of my environment. So I'm feeling you on what you're saying. And in many ways, think that that's a very interesting thing to be involved in. My concern, though, is I go back with this rural city thing, okay? And I think that we should be able to find the similar circumstances, academic circumstances, within a urban environment that you can find in a rural environment, and maybe that'll be a way of bridging that gap that exists between when those kids grow up, they won't be like their parents and may be a little bit more, not be as reluctant for the kids to experience things outside of the urban environment. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think so. The key for people connecting to nature is relevance. If you help people understand that, for example, that cardinal, the red bird that you love to watch,
right?
That cardinal has the same requirements of clean air and clean water. It can live with some of those things, but not as well as it does if the air is clean, if the water is clean, if there are abundant resources. So try to help people understand that the struggles that the birds have in many ways are the struggles that we have, that when you begin to notice fewer birds around, that it often points to ecological problems. And so, you know, that relevance of nature and folks understanding that they have a role in it, that we aren't separate from it, that is the critical thing. And as people, you know, especially for very young children, understanding that helps them develop an ethic and a way of being and a way of living that includes nature and doesn't have them afraid of it or simply living to take advantage of it. But having them instead to live in harmony, hopefully, some sort of harmony with it. And if we can get that thing going, then, you know, I think it'll be a new day.
Okay, I'm going to pass out this number once again. If you're out there listening and you would like to call in, you make a comment or add a suggestion, that's 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Mike, you want to give out the place he's going to be again?
Yeah, again, just it is the Lawrence Public Library that's bringing him to Lawrence, but he will be speaking at Liberty Hall, which is, of course, on Massachusetts Street, right there downtown. And And then the birding event the next morning is at the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center. And you can find out a lot about this on the Lawrence Library's website. And yeah, I just had a quick question, Dr. Lanham. Tell us, you've written more than one book now, is that right?
Well, this The Home Place is my first book, and then I have a chapbook of poetry that's out, and in the process now of working on hopefully what are my second, third, and fourth books. So I've got about three book projects going right now, but I've written a lot. A lot of my work that's not tied up in the book has been published in various magazines, including a Lion magazine and Audubon. So I've written a lot, and it's in a lot of different places out there.
Yeah, well, that's good. And so I'm just curious, how did this happen? How did you, end up coming to Kansas? Did they reach out to you?
It's funny because the book seems to have gathered a good bit of reach, and a mutual friend, I think, Shirley Bromwich, who had read the book, reached out to me and said, "I've read this book, and I think it's an important work, and we'd like to have you come to Kansas and talk about it." And so I quite honestly, I was pretty shocked initially that that the book had reached that far west. And now it's, I've done book readings all the way out to Seattle and up into Alaska. So it's nice to know that when you write, and I write with the intent of communicating something to others. And so it's very gratifying when the words that you write touch people in ways that make them think and hopefully make them feel. And when they feel deeply enough and are thinking hard enough about something, then these sorts of things happen. So when she invited me nearly a year ago, I believe it was, I jumped at the opportunity to come to a new place and to be able to talk about what nature means to me, but hopefully also influence others to think about nature and more, think about it more broadly and more inclusive ways, and to not be afraid to share your heart when you're talking about conservation.
Well, with you coming, you made me realize that we have a husband and wife here in Kansas, in Kansas City, that are engaged in outdoor, I'll use the term education for lack of knowing exactly what you call it. And it just dawned on me, I had never had them on this show. In fact, they're supposed to be coming on. They were supposed to be here, but something came up and they couldn't get here. But we're going to give them a call when we end our part here with you, so they'll still have a chance to introduce them, and I'm going to have them coming on the show. And I have no excuse for that. It just never dawned on me. And we bring in people every week, But you doing, sure. But you coming to town and us discussing you made me think about them. I want to bring something up to you, and let's talk the migration. You find how frequently do you find that birds that are uncommon for a particular area ends up being in that area? And then I'll tell you why I'm asking you that when you answer that.
Well, this time of year is one of my favorite times of year. This time of year in the fall, when birds are on the move, they're on the move all the time, but this time of year is when you notice them the most. And so, for example, in a few hours as dusk descends and the sun sets, then birds will begin to become very active, and some of those birds will lift into the sky and fly around a couple of times to sort of assess and gain their bearings, and then they'll take off for someplace away from here that is closer to where they intend to be, perhaps to breed. And so the wonderful thing about migration is that it brings gifts to you every day. It brings gifts of birds to you every day, birds that maybe you've seen before but you haven't seen in a very long time, or maybe something that's rare that you've never seen.
Yes.
And so it's a critical time, and it's a fun time. But, I also like for people to think about the birds, the rare birds that they see, and imagine sort of the miraculous journey that birds have made, some of them traveling thousands of miles with just the built-in GPS in their evolved brains and the power behind feathers and wings and hopefully a tailwind. And, you know, there are times when you're watching birds that just a few weeks before were in a totally different place. Maybe they were, if you're thinking about some shorebirds, they could have been literally at the other end of the earth in some place like Tierra del Fuego. And then you're seeing them on your beach or in your marsh, or you're seeing some passerine, some songbird that just a few weeks before was in a tropical forest, and okay, Now it's in your forest.
Doc, we got a caller.
Birds bring the world to us.
Okay, we got a caller on the line. I didn't mean to cut you off. And when you finish with this caller, I'm going to come back in and talk about that migration with you. Caller, you on the air. Will you tell us your first name and the part of the city you're calling from, please?
Okay, I'm actually Wayne Hubbard. I'm the host of Every American Outdoors TV show. And I have been enjoying this conversation. Absolutely. Doc, thank you.
you're very welcome. Your name is Wayne again?
My name's Wayne.
Wayne, pleasure to meet you, Wayne.
This was the other guy and his wife who were supposed to be coming to the station that ran into some difficulties and couldn't make it. And we were going to call them when we took a break, when we finished with you. But what I'm going to do now is say, Wayne, now that you're on the line, let me check to see if we can keep you on the line, or you just go ahead and ask this question.
I just wanted to speak to Doc. I didn't want to let him go without me speaking to Doc.
You go right ahead.
I want to say this. Thank you for your tenacity. One of the things that's very important to me is when it comes to outdoors and conservation, we have to look at every mean to connect persons to nature. And one of the things that I look at is birding as a whole is a soft way and a wonderful way to connect to nature. One of the things that I wanted to ask you that's very relevant to me and what I do is how can young people and individuals look at birding not only just as a space for them to come look at it, but is there opportunities in careers, specifically into that urban community, that diverse community? How can they look at that as a potential to be a career? Because the way that we make environment better is the people, as diverse as birds is, so should the people who protect them and work with them. So I would like to like to get your answer on that aspect, and I'm going to step back off, but I just was excited to hear that you were on the phone.
Thanks, Wayne.
Well, thank you, Wayne, so much for your work and your passion to nature. You know, it can be a career, and I'm a living witness of that. And but it's man, there's so many things and opportunities for people to be a part of conservation and careers in conservation. And literally now people are doing rocket science to, for example, understanding how birds travel using telemetry and remote sensing and the technology that's there to help us understand where birds go. And I love to see teachers use birds and nature in the classroom, not just to talk about the biology of it, which is obvious and important, but also to talk about science, to talk about technology, to talk about even the engineering and math that goes into understanding how we track birds or how we can think about restoring environments and habitats and all of those things. And more so than STEM, which most of us are used to hearing about, again, science, technology, engineering, and math, I like for people to think about STEAM. That's science, technology, arts, engineering, arts, and math. And so in that STEAM, also to understand that the artistic side of what we do, whether it's photography, whether it's writing, whether it's painting, whether it's sculpture, whether it's dance, you know, so many cultures are connected to birds through dance, And it's something that we ignore. So everyone likes to dance at some level. Watch cranes, watch sandhill cranes dance. And there's a chance that in some of these wetlands that we visit on Friday, there's a chance that we'll see sandhill cranes. And if you ever watch a pair of sandhill cranes pair bonding, a male and a female, and you watch that dance, then you're looking at a dance that has been imitated and admired by people all over the world. Cranes are important birds for many, many people. And so I like for people to find their way in nature however they can find it, whether it's boulders or birds or butterflies, but to understand that we can all have a part in it, and that nature being all around us is one of our greatest teachers.
Okay, I got
to be able to sit and watch. Okay. You know, as Richard said, to be able to sit and watch redbirds.
Yes.
And to watch their behavior. And I'll tell you, one of the things that we don't pay enough attention to, but it's really hard to be in nature and watching and to be relaxed and not understand that there are health benefits as well. That the amount of stress in our bodies is often lessened, that we relax, that sometimes, even if for a moment, we can take our minds away from sort of every minute's breaking news story of something bad. We can be in a place of peace, oftentimes of solitude, that it can be a place of spiritual renewal. Man, it's everything out there.
Doc, I got to get in here on you. We got two things. I got two callers on the line, and we got a break we got to take. So I'm bringing one of the callers on, and when you get through answering hers, then we'll take a break, and then we'll get the other caller. So,
certainly.
Okay, yeah, we'll let you know the break's coming. All right.
I think just to step in here, I think what we're going to do is, because Wayne called back for the other segment, so we're going to hold off on him till after the break,
okay.
And we'll just wrap up with Dr. Lanham. We'll take Elaine's call.
We'll wrap up with him, and then we'll take Wayne. Yeah. You covered. So what we're going to do is this next caller on, and this is one of my Sierra Club buddies. Elaine, come on.
I'm here, Mr. Mabian. You know, I had a follow-up question on the migration with climate change. I noticed in our yard the tulip tree and the arrival of the oriole birds did not seem to coincide this year. And perhaps Dr. Lana might talk about how climate change may be impacting the migration that way.
Thank you, ma'am.
Wow, great question. Elaine is the name?
Yes, Elaine.
Elaine, yeah.
She's a biologist, too.
Well, it's, you know, climate change is having dramatic impact on, in so many ways, impacting nearly every facet of our lives. I can tell you specifically with orioles, you know, a lot of folks think of Baltimore orioles as being birds of the tropics. I mean, look at that bird. It looks tropical, right? It looks like someone threw a creamsicle up into a tree, and that creamsicle sings, and we're all wowed by that. But I'll tell you, Baltimore Orioles are now staying in South Carolina all year round. And we think that is in part the influence of climate change. And it's not necessarily a new phenomenon that they've been staying around, but that Orioles are staying, that we're finding them in greater abundance, and then people are feeding them. The thing that they feed them here either are orange halves or grape jelly. And so the birds are finding sustenance here, but we think that there are also impacts of climate change that are having impacts not just on orioles, but other birds like American robins, you know, the bird that Roger Torrey Peterson said that everybody knows, that's a bird that's appearing on its northern wintering or its northern breeding grounds sooner and sooner because of the ground that's thawed and the birds are able to avail themselves of food earlier. And so sometimes it works out for the birds. Oftentimes it doesn't. When arrival is mismatched, for example, with food resources or lack thereof. And so, you know, what we're looking at really is some of the cogs and wheels that one of my heroes, Aldo Leopold, talked about. And we're talking about those cogs and wheels not meshing always as they should. So we can think about, you know, these many of these species have evolved, you know, in this world along with what we would like to think of in our minds, at least in human scale, is relatively stable environments. We know that there's climate change over geologic time. We understand that. But what's happened with this escalation of so many carbon footprints that we've essentially sped things up, that we've increased the rate of change
right,
such that some individuals, some species, some populations are having a difficult time keeping up. And that includes humans.
Right.
And, you know, I tell people one of the things that's most important for our message about climate change is impact on human health. Any day during the summer, and it's probably already started, you can look at your weather forecast, and there will be days when the weather person says, due to air conditions, people with chronic pulmonary disorders probably shouldn't go outside today.
We had our first orange ozone alert here in Kansas City on Friday.
There you go.
Yeah, it is.
There you go. And the interesting thing is that we also understand that that many of the conditions, many of these chronic pulmonary conditions, these respiratory conditions, visit communities of color and poor people at much greater incidence than they do majority communities. So guess what? Climate change is impacting people in very real ways and oftentimes visiting communities of color in ways that we need to be aware and we need to understand our connection to the environment. And so, again, when I talk about relevance, as much as I love to talk about the wildlife that climate change is impacting and help people understand what's going on, part of our duty, I think, as conservationists, as environmentalists, is to make sure that we all stay connected to nature in ways that it's relevant to us, that we don't just see it as wildlife, that we don't just see it as wild places, but that nature is where we are every day, whether you're in an urban setting or a rural setting, and paying attention can make a difference.
Well, Dr. Lanham, I really, really appreciate you. I mean, I'm sorry that we run out of time. It's always like that when we're really enjoying ourselves. We'd like to know that we may be able to have you back on sometime. I'm sure there's plenty that we could engage in conversation. I have lots of stuff I could talk to you about, and that migrated bird that I was going to bring up, and I'll save the story till the next time. I'm going to make you figure out, wonder what it was that happened. It was a buzzard.
Well, you piqued my interest.
It was a buzzard. Ended up in a downtown inner city, because the part of town I live in used to be forest, and one day I was going home, and I saw this strange-looking animal. And I turned around and came back, and I wanted to take a picture of it, but he looked like he was looking at me. So I don't know nothing about him. And I was scared to get out of my car. So I'm going to let you go, sir. We got to go, and we really appreciate you coming on. And if I get his way, I can get up there and see you while you're in town this weekend. I will do that, sir.
Well, I would look very much forward to it, Richard. And thank you so much for your time and for your work and blazing the trail to make conservation and environmentalism a more colorful endeavor. Thank you, sir.
Have a good evening.
Thank you, Dr. Lanham. And Dr. Lanham will be in Lawrence speaking at Liberty Hall on Thursday evening, courtesy of the Lawrence Public Library, and leading a birding expedition, as it were, at the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center on Friday morning. So you can find out more of that by the Lawrence Public Library's website. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll have our other guests on the phone. And you are tuned to Eco Radio KC here on 90.1 FM.
She's beautiful when she's angry. A reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement between 1966 and 1971. This documentary explores the emergence of political thought that challenged patriarchy. On Making Contact, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
Hello, this is Martha Lally, producer of KKFI 90.1 FM's Anything Goes show with Charles Ferrugia and Carol Jean Barta. Carol Jean, since the late 1990s, there's been a sudden disappearance of bees.
That's right, Martha. And you know, bees make more than just honey. They are key to our food production.
Find out more about the disappearance of bees in the state of Kansas, Missouri, and the nation.
That's Fridays at noon on Anything Goes.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Going solar does not only cut carbon pollution. At Stead Elementary School in Reno, Nevada, it's also a learning opportunity. 2 years ago, the local utility helped the school install solar panels. The initiative was part of a state program designed to provide solar energy to low-income communities.
It's very low-income neighborhood that feeds into the school.
Jason Geddes is Energy and Sustainability Manager for the Washoe County School District. He says the power generated by the solar panels last year saved Stead Elementary more than $16,000. Students, parents, and teachers got to choose how most of that money would be spent.
They all came to the conclusion that laptops would be the best use for the money this year. Students really like it because it does give the kids access to computers that they normally wouldn't have, and not all of the students have access to computers at home.
Getty says the solar initiative has supported learning in other ways, too.
The sun is producing electricity that is feeding your classroom. It's just great to see the kids learning from that and being more interested in science because these things are sitting right out their window and they can see the direct benefit.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, I'm on. Candace, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm on the phone.
Boy, I am so sorry that we ended up this way, but I guess things work out that way. This is going to cause us to have you come back on, you and Wayne.
Well, see, that's fine. It worked out okay.
It worked out just fine. I would, because I want to be able to sit down and talk about you and your program and the things you all do just based on what I'm able to see and what I know about you. I think it'll be an interesting story, just as interesting as it was with Dr. Lanham. I think it'll be the same way with people hearing about you all. But what I want you to do is to, one, just tell us the name of your organization, and without getting too deep, because I only got a couple of minutes here,
right,
a little bit about what it is you all do, and then I want you to finish up talking about your weekend that's coming up.
Okay, and I'll start and just tell you about myself and then hand it over to Wayne so he can go ahead and close it out.
Okay.
All right.
You got it. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, tell us about yourself. And you own.
Okay. I'm Candace Price. I'm the executive producer of Urban American Outdoors and also co-founder of Urban American Productions. We have a production company that created the TV show Urban American Outdoors that has been on air nonstop since 2003. We started in 1999 putting this together, a TV show that represented outdoors from a different perspective. So Wayne is the host, I'm a producer, and we collaboratively put it together and just created this Emmy-nominated television show that's been on, you know, for years. And we cover all kind of aspects, conservation, environment, you know, public lands, natural resources, the people, and making sure diversity and inclusion is included in this conversation and with what we do.
Okay.
But I'm going to pass you over to Wayne.
Okay.
He is our host, and he can bring you up to speed to everything that we're doing.
All right. Well, we will have you back. Wayne, we got 1 minute, sir.
If I got 1 minute, then what we're going to talk about is that we have the Urban Kids Fishing Derby that's going to be coming June 17th.
Okay.
And the one that's in Kansas City, Missouri. And we want to invite everyone to come out and enjoy. It's a free event. And the grand prize is $100 for the youth that wins the biggest fish.
Well,
so
I want you both to know that I'm going to have you back on before then. I got a half a show opening between now and the 1st of June, and we'll make sure we get you back on, okay?
All right, fantastic. Thank
all
you.
Right, sir. We'll talk to you later now.
Bye now.
Thank you.
All right, and we're not going to have time for This Week in Water. But I will remind you really quick about Dr. Lanham speaking at Liberty Hall Thursday night and at the Baker Wetlands Friday morning.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.